File 41.
After my discharge from hospital, I was sent to a reserve battalion there. I felt as in some strange town. Anger, discontent, complaints met one's ears wherever one went. To a certain extent, this was due to the infinitely maladroit manner in which the soldiers who had returned from the front were treated by the non-commissioned officers who had never seen a day's active service, and who, on that account, were partly incapable of adopting the proper attitude towards the old soldiers. Naturally, those old soldiers displayed certain characteristics which had been developed from the experiences in the trenches. The officers of the reserve units could not understand these peculiarities, whereas the officer home from active service was at least in a position to understand them for himself. As a result, he received more respect from the men than officers at the home headquarters. But apart from all this, the general spirit was deplorable. The art of shirking was looked upon as almost a proof of higher intelligence, and devotion to duty was considered a sign of weakness or bigotry. Government offices were staffed by Jews. Almost every clerk was a Jew, and every Jew was a clerk. I was amazed at this multitude of combatants who belonged to the chosen people, and could not help comparing it with their slender numbers in the fighting lines. In the business world, the situation was even worse. Here, the Jews had actually become indispensable. Like leeches, they were slowly sucking the blood from the pores of the national body. By means of newly floated war companies, an instrument had been discovered whereby all national trade was throttled so that no business could be carried on freely. Special emphasis was laid on the necessity for unhampered centralization. Hence, as early as 1916-17, practically all production was under the control of Jewish finance. But against whom was the anger of the people directed? It was then that I already saw the fateful day approaching, which must finally bring the debacle, unless timely preventive measures were taken. While Jewry was busily despoiling the nation and tightening the screws of its despotism, the work of inciting the people against the Prussians increased, and just as nothing was done at the front to put a stop to the venomous propaganda, so here at home no official steps were taken against it. Nobody seemed capable of understanding that the collapse of Prussia could never bring about the rise of Bavaria. On the contrary, the collapse of the one must necessarily drag the other down with it. This kind of behavior affected me very deeply. In it, I could see only a clever Jewish trick for diverting public attention from themselves to others. While Prussians and Bavarians were squabbling, the Jews were taking away the sustenance of both from under their very noses. While Prussians were being abused in Bavaria, the Jews organized the revolution and with one stroke smashed both Prussia and Bavaria. I could not tolerate this execrable squabbling among people of the same German stock, and preferred to be at the front once again. Therefore, just after my arrival in Munich, I reported myself for service again. At the beginning of March 1917, I rejoined my old regiment at the front. Towards the end of 1917, it seemed as if we had got over the worst phases of moral depression at the front. After the Russian collapse, the whole army recovered its courage and hope, and all were gradually becoming more and more convinced that the struggle would end in our favour. We could sing once again. The ravens were ceasing to croak. Faith in the future of the fatherland was once more in the ascendant. The Italian collapse in the autumn of 1917 had a wonderful effect, for this victory proved that it was possible to break through another front besides the Russian. This inspiring thought now became dominant in the minds of millions at the front and encouraged them to look forward with confidence to the spring of 1918. It was quite obvious that the enemy was in a state of depression. During this winter, the front was somewhat quieter than usual. But that was the calm before the storm. Just when preparations were being made to launch a final offensive which would bring this seemingly eternal struggle to an end, while endless columns of transports were bringing men and munitions to the front, and while the men were being trained for that final onslaught, then it was that the greatest act of treachery during the whole war was accomplished in Germany. Germany must not win the war. At that moment, when victory seemed ready to alight on the German standards, a conspiracy was arranged for the purpose of striking at the heart of the German spring offensive with one blow from the rear and thus making victory impossible. A general strike in the munition factories was organized. If this conspiracy could achieve its purpose, the German front would have collapsed, and the wishes of the Vorwärts, the organ of the Social Democratic Party, that this time victory should not take the side of the German banners, would have been fulfilled. For want of munitions, the front would be broken through within a few weeks, the offensive would be effectively stopped, and the Entente saved. Then international finance would assume control over Germany, and the internal objective of the Marxist national betrayal would be achieved. That objective was the destruction of the national economic system and the establishment of international capitalistic domination in its stead. And this goal has really been reached, thanks to the stupid credulity of the one side and the unspeakable treachery of the other. The munition strike, however, did not bring the final success that had been hoped for, namely to starve the front of ammunition. It lasted too short a time for the lack of ammunition as such to bring disaster to the army, as was originally planned, but the moral damage was much more terrible. In the first place, what was the army fighting for if the people at home did not wish it to be victorious? For whom, then, were these enormous sacrifices and privations being made and endured? Must the soldiers fight for victory while the home front goes on strike against it? In the second place, what effect did this move have on the enemy? In the winter of 1917-1918, dark clouds hovered in the firmament of the Entente. For nearly 4 years, onslaught after onslaught has been made against the German giant, but they failed to bring him to the ground. He had to keep them at bay with one arm that held the defensive shield, because his other arm had to be free to wield the sword against his enemies, now in the east, and now in the south. But at last these enemies were overcome, and his rear was now free for the conflict in the west. Rivers of blood had been shed for the accomplishment of that task, but now the sword was free to combine in battle with the shield on the western front. And since the enemy had hitherto failed to break the German defense here, the Germans themselves had now to launch the attack. The enemy feared and trembled before the prospect of this German victory. At Paris and London, conferences followed one another in unending series. Even the enemy propaganda encountered difficulties. It was no longer so easy to demonstrate that the prospect of a German victory was hopeless. A prudent silence reigned at the front, even among the troops of the Entente. The insolence of their masters had suddenly subsided. A disturbing truth began to dawn on them. Their opinion of the German soldier had changed. Hitherto they were able to picture him as a kind of fool whose end would be destruction. But now they found themselves face to face with the soldier who had overcome their Russian ally. The policy of restricting the offensive to the east, which had been imposed on the German military authorities by the necessities of the situation, now seemed to the Entente as a tactical stroke of genius. For 3 years, these Germans had been battering away at the Russian front without any apparent success at first. Those fruitless efforts were almost sneered at. For it was thought that in the long run, the Russian giant would triumph through sheer force of numbers. Germany would be worn out through shedding so much blood. And facts appeared to confirm this hope. Since the September days of 1914, when for the first time interminable columns of Russian war prisoners poured into Germany after the Battle of Tannenberg, it seemed as if the stream would never end, but that as soon as one army was defeated and routed, another would take its place. The supply of soldiers which the gigantic empire placed at the disposal of the Tsar seemed inexhaustible. New victims were always at hand for the holocaust of war. How long could Germany hold out in this competition? Would not the day finally have to come when, after the last victory which the Germans would achieve, there would still remain reserve armies in Russia to be mustered for the final battle? And what then? According to human standards, a Russian victory over Germany might be delayed, but it would have to come in the long run.